Okay, welcome friends and colleagues to our third seminar of the Sufi Studies Network for 2023. Before introducing our guest, please allow me to acknowledge country and pay my respects to its custodians and say that I live and work on Darug land. Now, to our guest, it's an absolute pleasure to introduce my good friend and colleague, Vasilios Andradis, whom I have known for quite some time and with whom I have had many rich and wonderful conversations. He is to me a true Hellene, if I may say, Vasily. And I have known him personally in our conversations to be the Hellenic philosopher that I believe he is. Formerly, Vasily holds a PhD in sociology of religion from Pantheon University of Social and Political Sciences, Athens, Greece, and a PhD in studies in religion from the University of Sydney. He specializes in the political phenomenology of early Christianity, patristics, Byzantine philosophy, the history of religions, and Indigenous Australian studies. He has authored and co-edited more than 10 books. Over the years, we have worked together on a number of articles concerning the historical and political question of Islam, and we have produced a co-edited volume to that effect. Our next project, which I'm excited about, is to shed further light on the interreligious relationship between Eastern Christianity and Sufism from the early period to the modern. And it's going to be a thrilling ride, and I'm very excited to be part of that journey with Vasily again. So today, Vasily is going to talk to us about Prince Dimitri Cantemir as a historian of religion, his pioneering work on Sufi orders. As usual, we'll have a 30-minute recorded talk and followed by a 20-minute unrecorded Q&A session with Vasily. Thank you, and over to you, Vasily. Welcome.
Thank you, Milad. Thanks for the invite, Milad and Aydogan. It's always a pleasure to be at the Sufi Network Studies, either participating as a listener or as a presenter. Today, of course, I will attempt to present some reflections and some sort of information on Prince Dimitri Cantemir, and more specifically about his work on Islam, and more specifically, the part that is dedicated to the Sufi orders. Now, I'm no specialist on the work of Dimitri Cantemir. Actually, I was totally unaware of the prince 3 years ago, but I had a talk with out of the blue with a friend of mine, a Romanian Orthodox priest who did his Master of Philosophy thesis in religious studies in Thessaloniki. And there he devoted his thesis on the work of Prince Dimitri Cantemir, which is of interest for us today. Now, that work is in its original title, which was actually Russian, because it was published in 1722. By the way, Dimitri Cantemir was born in 1673, died in 1723. He died 50 years old. So 1 year before his death, this work was published in St. Petersburg. And the title is Kniga Sistema ili Sostoyanie Ukhabedanitskaya Religie, which of course translates to a systematic treatise of the constitution, the structure of the Muhammadan religion. Now, it might strike someone as, you know, a bit of clearly a pejorative way to describe the religion as Muhammadan religion. And perhaps I have to make this note here that there are certain terms in the work, this work, and other works of Kadhimir on Islam, certain terms like, you know, Muhammadan, or as we will see, sect, or descriptions as false. And some have regarded them just as pejorative and value-laden discourse. But a better contextualization of his work reveals that he, because he was publishing these in Russia, and because everything published in Russia at the time was under the inspection and approval of the Holy Synod of the Church, they had to, you know, get a tick. So in a way, he had to use here and there some sort of terminology to get away with it. And that's how modern scholarship approaches the sort of terminology and seemingly pejorative language. Of course, we should keep in mind that Kadhimir was an Orthodox Christian, and he believed that his religion was the truth. There's no, doubt about that. But I'm just making a broader contextualization so we can understand this sort of, you know, pejorative terminology. Now, another work that has that he wrote, which is, much more known, is the work by the title Incrementorum et Decretorum Aulae Ottomanicae Historiae, which basically is the rise and the decline of the Ottoman Empire. And of course, everyone, I suppose, thinks of Gibbon's work, you know, the growth and rise of the decline of the Roman Empire. And by the way, Gibbon, to quite an extent, based his perspective and understanding of history on Kadhimir's work. And then he has another work on Islam, which is not that systematic or quite organized, but it's basically a collection, and it's called Collectanea Orientalia. Now, I will be saying, and you know, adding notes here and there, because our time is limited, I will go straight ahead to the part of the book that refers to the Sufi orders. Now, the Tecnica Systema is divided into six books. And everything he has to say about the Turuq is in the sixth book. And actually, in chapters 8 to 18, in 10 chapters, 11 actually. Now, in chapter 8, he starts by referring, the title is On the Sects of the Dervishes. That is, on monks or monastics in general. Now, we see here the sects, which of course is a quite loaded terminology, and actually in those days it was very, very pejorative. It's not even a heresy, it's a sect. Now, on the other hand, he uses monks, monastics, and although he was in his general outlook concerning Islam and, of course, Sufism, very, I would say, descriptive, in a quite pioneering way. Even we could say, you know, that he, in a way, anticipates the early schools of the phenomenology of religion, which were very, very descriptive, just describing the object in front of them. So, and we would say that description is a sort of, you know, neutral thing, but we know that nothing is neutral. And of course, description itself is not neutral. So although he's describing, he's framing at the same time by calling them monks and monastics, he is in a Christian way framing them and presenting what he goes on to describe. Now, all this exploration that he has on the Sufi orders is to a great extent not based, but I would say utilizes and makes use of a work that was written in 1666, so around the mid of the 17th century, and it was called The Present State of the Ottoman Empire, and it was written by Paul Ricoh. Now, Kademir uses the work, but he uses it quite selectively, creatively. He doesn't just copy the work. But it's one of his basic non-Muslim sources. Generally, Kademir, in his works on Islam, uses Muslim sources. And for that matter, Ottoman sources. He was, you know, very knowledgeable in Turkish, in Farsi, in Arabic, apart from the other languages that he knew, Latin, Greek, and Slavonic. Now, he starts by making a distinction between, not a distinction, but clarifying things, the word dervis and how it comes from the Farsi word darwish. And then he makes a reference to the Arabic term zahir. He makes this in order to show that, that's what he says, although dervish means poor, the zahir has a different semantic value and let's say weight. It means the one who is disciplined and withdraws from the worldly goods and worldly things in order to devote themselves totally to God. Then he goes on to divide the orders of the dervish orders into three types. Now, he deals only with the Turuk and with what I like calling, you know, ritualistic Sufism. That is the third, you know, stage of Sufism. If as first we regard ascetic or pietistic Sufism, and then as second, the contemplative, the great contemplative tradition of Sufism. He deals only with the ritualistic side of Sufism, the tariqa side of it, from the 1200s onwards. So these orders he divides into the teke based orders, into the itinerant orders, without any, you know, specific and stable location. And then in between type, which we could call teke funding. So there is a teke, but the some of the dervishes that belong to that teke go out into the world, they collect monies or food or whatever, and they bring them back to the teke in order to sustain the life of their fellow brothers. So these are the three types that he sort of distinguishes that to look into. And here we do see this not only descriptive phenomenology, but also the typological phenomenology. He also has this a way of not just describing, but also categorizing and making types of things. And as you will see further on as I continue, although he relies a lot on written evidence, written witnesses, literature, he also draws heavily on his personal observations. And I think that from the perspective of a European, one could say, he's the first that presents a work so rich in personal observation, what nowadays we would call, field work concerning Islam and the Turuq. Now, in the ninth chapter, he refers to the first people that established the Dervish orders. Now, he mentions two people, that's Halveti and Naqshband or Naqshband. And of course, these two are related to the Kalwati and Naqshbandiya Tariqa. Now, he refers to them, but as he goes on, he says that these are the two first Tariqa that appeared in Turkey. And he takes them back to Ali and Abu Bakr. Now, there is a, of course, he knows the ideology, the silsila ideology, the behind the understanding of the tariqa, all the tariqas go back to Ali and Muhammad, actually. But I think that his sources didn't allow him to really check his dates. And that's where, for instance, we can see an inaccuracy as to the presentation of these two orders as being the first orders that appeared in Turkey and going back to Ali. I think he makes another sort of mistake when he connects the Mevleviya with the Naqshbandiya. Now, again, this might be a mistake due to his sources or due to his informants, or it might reflect at the time a sense of, interconnection between all sort of traditions, tariqa traditions. What comes to mind, is something that we see afterwards, a bit afterwards, in the fourth period of Sufism, after the ritualistic Sufism, we have the neo-Sufi orders, we have discussed this with Milad quite a lot of times, especially referring to the work of Armando Salvatore, whom, when he discusses this after the 1500s expression of Sufism, he really speaks about a network of Sufi orders throughout the non-Western world. And this network functioned as a watershed, to the encroaching powers of colonial powers. Now, this network being, created after the 1500s, which implies that Sufi orders were more and more becoming familiar with one another and, in a way, out of courtesy, one would say, spiritual courtesy, one would connect themselves to the other in a genealogical sense. And that's how they could make out of the practical network also an ideological network. And I think perhaps because Kantemir is writing in the early 18th century, when this is already there, it's consolidated, perhaps this reflects this networking. Otherwise, historically, he's wrong. Kantemir is wrong. Now, the 10th chapter is on the Mevleviya. And it's the first tariqa that he deals with. He regards it as the most important tariqa in the Ottoman Empire. Of course, he refers to the center of the Mevleviya in Konya. He also refers to Othman, the son of Osman, who really supported the Mevleviya. And he notes that in his own times, that's Kantemir's times, there were about 500 dervishes in Konya, Mevleviya dervishes in Konya. He also informs us that in Constantinople there were four teke of the Mevleviya. And then he goes on to describe the dedication ritual of Mevlevi. And he says that at the beginning, the dervish stands in front of the sheikh, and the sheikh asks the dervish, the candidate, "May your arrival be in peace, O child." And the candidate says, "What has your good thought been?" And then the candidate expresses his wish, and the sheikh tried to urge him to go back to his normal life, regular life style. And then the candidate was supposed to, insist. And this would go on for three times. And after that, the sheikh would say, "It's the will of Allah." Now, this is very sort of, brief and very, I would say, concise. But it reminds me literature, but also because I have personal experience, I have witnessed it. It reminds me of part of the monastic vows in the Greek Orthodox Church of monks, the vows that they give. And there is a similar way to, a similar ritual where you appear before the elder and he asks you, "What are you doing here? Why have you come? And what have you been thinking of this?" And he replies, "To be part of, your group." And this goes on three times. And after the three times, the actual ritual starts. And that's where Kantemir describes their investment. Okay, the investiture, actually. The candidate is given the vestments, the clothes, and the headdress of the Mevleviya dervish. And everyone congratulates, of course, a new member, and they wish him grace, strength, affliction, patience, humility, virginity, silence, obedience, and the hardships of poverty. Now, once one is a member of the Mevleviya, he has to go through a period of 9 years. which are divided into three slots of 3 years. The first 3 years, he does the most, let's say, nasty work in the teke, cleaning everything. The 3 years after that, he's in the kitchen, serving everyone, you know. And in the three last years, he serves the other brothers in the their other needs. So this sort of serving different needs in an ascending order of, let's say, value. After those 9 years, if he makes it, he becomes a dede. And then he devotes, then the Mevlevigya says, Kadimir devote themselves to poetry, to rhetoric, and the study of music. Of course, he mentions the famous, you know, ney, the instrument ney. In more or less a way, he goes through all the dervish orders in the same manner, describing how they become a dervish, what do they wear, what do they say during the ritual, what sort of virtues are expected from them. And in some cases, of course, he makes, let's say, more specific descriptions and qualifications regarding the distinctiveness of the orders. So beyond the Mevlevigya, he refers to the Bektashiya as the second most important Sufi order in the Ottoman Empire. The only sort of addition here, specifically for the Bektashiya, is regarding the Yenichery association that they had, and that they were known as those who give water to everyone, water to the soldiers and water to the people that they might, you know, come across on a road or anywhere. And he makes the quite interesting note that they would offer water by taking off their headdress, which was quite hollow, and they would put the water in and offer it to the people, you know. That's why the headdress had it was of a certain, you know, shape, in order to be suitable for this sort of purposes. There's lots of that sort of, you know, in his work, there's lots of that sort of exotica when he deals with Sufism. The next dervish order is the Kalenderiya. And there he does focus on the various practices of self-mortification that the Kalenderiya were practicing, and especially their intense memory of death as a spiritual exercise. He refers to the dervish is called Kadri. Now, this is a quite interesting case because we could regard him as, in some respect, a more radical form of the Kalenderiya, but also distinctive in their own on their own. Now, to give you an example, he says that the Kadri have a mystical sort of prayer that they say without the utterance, the actual utterance and wording being heard. So we could call it a kind of spiritual prayer. So although they move their lips, they talk. There's no utterance and there's no wording. They do it in the ear of the brothers. So it's like a kind of mystical transmission. And thanks to this sort of prayer, this mystical prayer, he makes the comment that they are in a position to penetrate into lots and different divine heavenly visions. Their life was quite an austere one, very austere lifestyle. The Sheikh wishes the candidate or says to them, if your body does not become dry, as this green tree I'm giving you right now, they used to give them green trees, little trees, branches. So if your body doesn't become dry, as this green tree will become dry, then your soul will become dry and have no fruits, bear no fruits. The very, very interesting thing about the Qadriya is that they engaged in an ecstatic dance sounds session, and it was so ecstatic, so they would take off their clothes totally, and they would wear sheepskins instead. They would touch the shoulders of one another in a cyclical manner, and they would go round and round and round, faster and faster and faster and faster. And they would say at the same time, who, the divine name. So this could go on for hours. And it was so ecstatic that, and it was so loud that you were supposed to bleed. Either you would bleed, you know, from the lungs, or from your nose or whatever. Now, you were supposed to bleed because this was the proof that you made it. And the Sheikh would, out of the blood of the ecstatic dancing of the Qadriya, write their names on the walls of the teke. And the name in blood was the proof that you made it as a accomplished Qadriya. Now, these are things that he has witnessed. It's not things that he has read about. So it's very, very interesting as a, I would say, a pioneering anthropological testimony in the field of religious studies. And then he refers to other dervish orders as the Torlak and the Ebribu Bahi. Now, some of these dervish orders are not Ottoman, or better to put it better, were not active in the Ottoman Empire, but in the rest of the Islamic world. Many of the Turuk that he refers to are not known anymore, or are very little known, even in the bibliography on Sufism. So, in a way, I suppose they were sort of specific developments in the Ottoman Empire for a certain period that became afterwards sort of inactive. it's worth, you know, looking into this from the perspective of the history of religion. We could go on talking afterwards, but what I would like to stress is that there's lots of this sort of exotica that he refers. He even refers to dervish stilites, stylites, which are the column dwellers, which was a very common practice in early Christianity or Byzantine Christianity in Syria and Palestine. Monks standing their whole lives or for many, many years on a column for purposes of self-mortification. And he refers to such dervishes, you know, in Egypt, for instance. And other sorts of, you know, exotica, which, you know, in a way sort of, I would say, perhaps would make, you know, more nowadays, more mainstream Muslims feel quite justified in their, you know, judgments against Sufism. You see what we have been saying? These, you know, are not real Muslims, you know, all these things they have been doing. So I think that the work, you know, could be in a way twisted to, you know, serve that sort of ideological polemic nowadays. But for me, it's a very, very interesting collection of an eyewitness concerning practices that he regarded as very, very pertinent and important. Otherwise, he wouldn't have included them. And as reflective of the sincerity, the faith, and the piety of the people involved in it. We'll stop here so we can chat. As I said, I'm in the process of, you know, familiarizing myself with the work. It's a huge work. It's around 400 pages. And unfortunately, we don't have it in English. So I'm trying basically from Latin and from the Greek translations that my friend has provided me with to try to look into the whole spectrum of how Kadhimir is dealing with Islam. Thank you.